All right, good morning. Okay, just to remember where we are, we're looking at the situation at the opening of the New Testament. We've already looked at the political situation, and we're finishing off the cultural situation today, hopefully. I plan to finish off the cultural situation today. And then the final thing we'll be looking at is the religious situation. So under the cultural situation thus far, we've looked at the Hellenization, the fact that the Greek culture had made inroads into Palestine. And we've also looked at, last week, we looked at the fact that the Jewish people were dispersed throughout the nations. And so those are the two things we've looked at so far under the cultural situation. And today we'll look at a couple other corollaries to that. One of them being sort of the corollary to the fact that the Jews were dispersed throughout the nations is the fact that we had a mixed population within Palestine also at the opening of the New Testament era. And so we've got Jews, Greeks, Romans, and Samaritans are the ones that we'll be talking about. We'll kind of lump Greeks and Romans together. So first of all, on the handout, we'll spend a few moments talking about the relationship with Jew and Gentile. So Gentiles here, I believe in Scripture, in the New Testament, the term Greek is often used to mean non-Jew. I guess it does mean Greek, but it's Greek culturally, not necessarily someone from Greece. So you'll sometimes see in the New Testament, sometimes the word will be translated Gentiles, and sometimes it will be translated Greek. I'm not sure what the actual, and maybe the actual term is Greek, but sometimes it's translated as Gentile. Because it's used in a context to refute to someone that's a non-Jew. And so we know from the Old Testament and into the New Testament what the relationship between Jews and Gentiles were. And we see that one of the exciting things about the New Testament and the coming of Jesus is that that wall, that barrier between Jew and Gentile was broken down by Jesus. We know that some of the Greek, translated Greeks, came to Jesus. In John chapter 12, we have a reference of Greeks seeking out Jesus to come and hear him. But then, of course, Jesus very profoundly ushered in the New Age by breaking down that wall between Jew and Gentile. And we see that then unfolding in the New Testament as the gospel goes to all the nations. And that first happens, as you remember, in Acts chapter 10. When Peter took the gospel to the Gentiles, to the house of Cornelius, if you remember that story. You know, that was a surprise to Peter from that story that he was to not call something unclean that the Lord was calling clean, if you remember his vision prior to going over to Cornelius' house. But furthermore, in the next chapter, Acts chapter 11, shows us that there was some serious explanation that was required by Peter to the elders in Jerusalem, if you remember. He had to recount the entire story because it was very unbelievable to them in Jerusalem that the gospel was going to now go to the Gentiles as well. And so we have that account in Acts chapter 11. And then, of course, we have further questions about how Gentiles were to be assimilated into the people of God. And we have that, for instance, in the so-called Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15, when they were meeting to discuss whether the Greeks that were coming into the church needed to basically become Jewish and follow Jewish customs as well. Circumcision, of course, was the main thing that was in view there. And that was a hard thing for the Jews to wrestle with because of that barrier that had been there for centuries between Jews and Gentiles. And then we also know, Pastor was just preaching about this a few weeks ago, it's a hard thing to accept even later for Peter. You remember, Peter was the one that took the gospel to Cornelius. And then in Galatians chapter 2, we have the interaction between Paul and Peter when Peter was separating from Gentiles and eating and things like that. So it was a very difficult thing for the early church to wrestle with, the breaking down of that wall, which, of course, most of us in this room are recipients of that, of the beneficiaries of that blessing of the gospel going to all the nations, which, of course, was predicted in the Old Testament. So it's interesting. So while the gospel was going forth to all the nations, and, of course, the Apostle Paul was taking the gospel in every town, he was taking it first to the synagogue traditionally. And then if the Jews rejected the message, then he would take it to the Greeks or to the Gentiles. But the non-Christian Jews, those who did not embrace Christianity, remained hostile to the Gentiles for the most part. And there's a couple examples of that in the New Testament that we could look at briefly in the life of the Apostle Paul. So in Acts chapter 21, I'll read a short passage here. You remember this story. This is when the Jews suspected Paul of bringing a Greek or a Gentile into the temple area. And it's instructive to look at the reaction to that. So in Acts chapter 21, I'll read starting at verse 27. When the 7 days were nearly over, that's the 7 days of the vow that Paul had made, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place. And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." They had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with Paul and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and his soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So one of the catalysts to this sort of mob scene was that they had suspected Paul of bringing a Gentile into the temple area. So that separation between Jew and Gentile was very much still in the forefront. Then we have sort of a sequel to that story in the next chapter, in Acts chapter 22, beginning at verse 19. This is now Paul is addressing the Jews. So this Paul has been rescued by the commander, and now he's being given freedom to speak to the Jews who were there. And he began telling them his story. And picking up in verse 19, he says this, "Lord," I replied, "these men know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Then the Lord said to me, 'Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" Now the crowd listened to Paul until he said this. Then they raised their voices and shouted, "Rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live." So you can see there the reaction of the Jews to just Paul merely saying that he was going to go to the Gentiles. That was a pretty vehement reaction. This is, of course, what Paul did throughout his ministry, was took the gospel to the Gentiles. That was his division of labor between the apostles in Jerusalem and himself. But taking the gospel to the Gentiles then was one factor in the Jewish persecution of the church. There were lots of factors in the Jewish persecution of the church in the early days. But one of the factors was that they weren't happy that the church was now inclusive, was including the Gentiles who they had been, you know, traditionally taught were to be excluded. So we have that dynamic in the opening of the New Testament in the culture at large now with this conflict between Jew and Gentile. And there's many other places in the New Testament that that's evident. But the second thing, to look at the second group that was in Palestine at the time, are the Samaritans. And we have a little bit of insight into the Jewish-Samaritan relations also in the New Testament. But there's some background to that that's important from the intertestamental period that leads up to that, those snippets that we see in the New Testament. So I'll kind of back up now, back into the intertestamental period, and look at the roots of some of that hostility. So we looked last time, we looked at the dispersion of the people into the other nations. And so the first time that that happened was after the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 BC. The Assyrians, as we were discussing last week, the Assyrians followed their policy of deporting the people and then resettling foreigners into the area that they had conquered. And we read about that in 2 Kings chapter 17. So in this particular case, non-Jews from Babylon, from Syria, from Elam, which is further to the east, were resettled in and around the area of Samaria. And remember, Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. So when it fell, that was the main area that was conquered and resettled. you know, we looked in the early days of this course, a long time ago, we looked at the resettlement of the land under Ezra and Nehemiah. And you remember that upon the return from exiles, the Jews faced continual opposition from the Samaritans. These were the people that were living in and around Samaria. And the reason they faced that opposition was because they were politically and economically threatened by Ezra first with the temple and then Nehemiah coming and actually rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. That was very threatening to them. It was encroaching on their territory and their sort of privileged relationship with the Persian rulers of the day. So you also remember that when Ezra came back, well, first of all, when they came back to rebuild the temple, the non-Jews were excluded from building the temple. You remember that some of the people came and tried to offer to help to rebuild the temple. And of course, that was a ruse just to get in and spy on them and see what they were doing. But the non-Jews were excluded from rebuilding the temple. And then we have the extensive opposition to the rebuilding of the walls under Nehemiah. And you remember all the various tricks that they tried to play on Nehemiah to try to get him to meet with them in a place where they could do him harm and things like that. At one point, they tried to get him to go hole up in the temple for his own safety. And there's multiple things that were happening at that time under Nehemiah. There were a couple different people in play there that were troubling Nehemiah, but a lot of the opposition came from this Samaritan group. You remember one of them was the name of Sanballat. He was one of the primary instigators against Nehemiah. So the Samaritans had been resettled there. What was their religion? They're in Israel, but what was their religion? Well, we're told very clearly what their religion was back in 2 Kings. So I'm going to turn there back in 2 Kings chapter 17. Essentially, the Samaritans were syncretists. So here in 2 Kings 17, we have the account of how Samaria was resettled. This is after the exile of the northern kingdom. And so picking up in verse 24, I'll read for us here. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. When they first lived there, they did not worship the Lord, so he sent lions among them, and they killed some of the people. It was reported to the king of Assyria, "The people you deported and resettled in the towns of Samaria do not know what the God of that country requires. He has sent lions among them, which are killing them off, because the people do not know what he requires." Then the king of Assyria gave this order, "Have one of the priests you took captive from Samaria go back to live there and teach the people what the God of that land requires." So one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship the Lord. Nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the several towns where they settled and set them up in the shrines the people of Samaria had made at the high places. The men from Babylon made Sukkot-Benot, the men from Cutha made Nergal, and the men from Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire as sacrifices to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They worshipped the Lord, but they also appointed all sorts of their own people to officiate for them as priests in the shrines at the high places. They worshipped the Lord, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the customs of the nations from which they had been brought. So there you get a really good insight, first of all, into where these people came from, resettling in Samaria, and then also what type of religious worship that they engaged in. And you can see from this that they were syncretists, which means they worshipped both Yahweh as well as the gods that they brought with them from their own lands. And you also might have noticed in the text there that Samaria is used of an area. They talk about the towns of Samaria. So Samaria was a city, but it was also, since it was the capital, it's also referred to as a general area. So another thing that happened during the intertestamental period, which isn't really recorded in the Bible, is that a rival temple was established on Mount Gerizim, and that's in Shechem. So there was a rival temple set up. There was a rival priesthood set up. So there were other priests ministering in Samaria. Their religion was similar to what we just read here. They were worshiping Yahweh, but they were also syncretists. They were worshiping other gods of the land. We're told in the intertestamental literature, for instance, in Josephus, we're told how that all happened. It happened with the Hellenization of the priesthood that we looked at a long time ago. There was a separation, and one of the priests who was driven out of Jerusalem, who was a Hellenist, went up to Samaria and got political support to set up this rival temple up there. This temple was probably then destroyed in 128 BC by John Hyrcanus, who was one of the Hasmonean dynasty rulers, if you remember, when we looked at the successors to the Maccabeans in the Maccabean Revolt. John Hyrcanus was one of the Hasmonean dynasty rulers, and we believe that he destroyed that temple on Mount Gerizim in 128 BC. So another factor in the interaction of Jews and Samaritans that we see in the New Testament, you remember when the Hellenization came in very strongly under the Seleucid rulers, and we've looked a couple times at the different reactions that the Jews had to that. Well, what was the reaction of the Samaritans? The Samaritans fully embraced Hellenism, so they would have been the ones that completely embraced it as opposed to resisting it. They actually pronounced themselves non-Jews to win the favor with the Hellenizers such as Antiochus IV, who was one of the main instigators of forced Hellenization. So the Samaritans complied with Antiochus and his forced Hellenization, while the Jews, on the other hand, particularly the ones who were resisting, were being killed for resisting the pagan rites. You can imagine what that did to the relationship then between the Jews, particularly the conservative Jews who were resisting Hellenization, and the Samaritans. That barrier and that animosity just continued to grow, and they were sort of pouring gasoline on the fire at that point. So all of that history of the intertestamental period resulted in this deep-seated animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans that we find in the New Testament. And so with that background in mind, let's take a quick look at a couple of the passages in the New Testament that speak to this. First one is Luke chapter 9. This is just an example of Samaritan hostility. Luke chapter 9, let's see, picking up at verse 51. The subtitle in my Bible here says Samaritan opposition. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples James and John saw this, they asked, "Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them?" But Jesus turned and rebuked them, and they went to another village. So you can see that the connection between somebody coming through headed for Jerusalem, that is the temple, and we're not going to welcome these people because of that. And that's just an example of the hostility. In John chapter 8, verse 48, you may recall this, I'm not going to turn there, but Samaritan, in quotes, is used as a derogatory term towards Jesus. I think that the actual verse says something like, "Aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed?" So you recall that, you know, "Aren't you a Samaritan?" You know, you can hear the kind of sarcasm or hostility in that statement. And then, of course, we have the woman at the well. Now, when you read this story with that background in mind, hopefully it makes a little more sense. The woman at the well in John chapter 4, let me read this passage for us, picking up at verse 4. "Now, he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, 'Will you give me a drink?' His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, 'You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans.' Jesus answered her, 'If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water.' 'Sir,' the woman said, You have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his flocks and herds? Jesus answered, Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. He told her, Go, call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Jesus declared, Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you shall worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. So you can see a couple different things going on there. We have a lot of insight here into the hostility between Jews and Samaritans again. You know, we've told here that Jews do not associate with Samaritans. The woman is astounded that Jesus is talking to her and asking for a drink. And then you also notice there, when they get to the part about worship, what does she say here? Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. That's probably a reference to the temple that was set up on Mount Gerizim. So, of course, the Bible doesn't expand on that here, but we know from the secular sources about that temple that was destroyed. So we can see here some insight into what was happening during the intertestamental period in Samaria in particular, and with worship. And then, of course, Jesus clarifies that salvation is from the Jews. Notice how also she refers to Jacob as her father. Okay, so you can see, just like, and Bill and I were just talking about the Herods, who the Herods were Jewish by religion, and they claimed to be Jewish, even though their ancestry was from Edom. You see the same kind of thing here. The Samaritans considered themselves Jews, unless it was expedient for them to not be Jews in the case of the persecution under Antiochus IV. So you can see that they want to claim the Jewish heritage, but there's that mixed blood there from the people that had been resettled from all the nations, and we've got the syncretistic religions, and all that stuff is jumbled up in the area of Samaria. And Jesus, of course, is clarifying that salvation is from the Jews, and really what the Father is looking for is people who worship in the right way in their hearts. And the time is coming when the temple worship is going to be no more anyways. Of course, because Jesus is the temple, is the new temple. So anyways, getting back to the point here, the point is that there's this hostility between Jews and Samaritans. And that hostility that had built up during the intertestamental period gives us insight into the things that are happening here in the Gospels. And then there's a couple other Samaritans that are mentioned. I won't read these passages, but you'll remember the stories. There's two stories, actually, regarding Samaritans, where Samaritans are mentioned to highlight the issues, really, not necessarily with the Samaritans, but with the Jewish attitudes. Can you think of one obvious example? The Good Samaritan, right, the parable of the Good Samaritan isn't so much about a Samaritan. It's about the fact that, you know, who is my neighbor, and what is our proper relationship to helping others? In highlighting the fact that the Jewish attitudes of the day would have passed by a person like that, whereas the Samaritan was the one that helped. We also have the story about the lepers that were healed by Jesus. Remember that. And who was the only one who came back to give thanks to God? It was the Samaritan. And Jesus said, only this Samaritan is the one that's going to come back and give thanks. So those are stories, you know, one event in a parable that are using that hostility, that hostile relationship between Samaritans to highlight a deficiency in the Jewish attitude of the heart. So we see the Samaritan relationship used in that way. And then, of course, in Acts, it all has kind of a happy ending, I guess. Because in Acts, the gospel goes to Samaria. So you remember in Acts chapter 8, Philip the evangelist went in consequence of the scattering of the people from Jerusalem, the persecution that broke out. The gospel went to Samaria, and Philip was actually the one that took the gospel to Samaria and had, you know, we had a good response of people accepting the gospel there. And, of course, that fulfills the spreading of the gospel that is laid out for us as a roadmap to Acts in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, that the gospel is going to go, you know, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So we see that then unfolding in the book of Acts. But anyways, in particular, the gospel went to Samaria and people responded to the gospel. So that's sort of the Samaritan background to what we find in these stories in the New Testament. Any questions or comments about that or anything that I've said so far before we move to the next section? All pretty clear? Yes? Yeah, that's a good question. So other than maybe to quell the lions, why did they want to bring the Jewish religion in after they were resettled? And I think it's probably just that mindset, you know, that pagan mindset that you need to be worshiping the local god, the god of that particular area. And we talked before about the pagan religions had the local gods that were in charge of fertility and crops and things like that. And apparently keeping you safe from lions was on that list also. So, you know, if these bad things are happening, there must be some religious thing that's wrong here. And, you know, we must not be worshiping the god of that local area the right way. So I think it was, you know, just simple, something simple like that. There's other examples of that in the Old Testament, too, where, thinking off the top of my head, but there's the one case where the god of the valleys or the god of the mountains, so let's not fight him there. That god doesn't have any power in the valley. Let's fight him in the valley. You know, so there's that mindset that the local gods had some authority, and it was limited, you know, that kind of thing. So, all right, any other questions or comments? Yeah, Bill. That's an excellent illustration of this point, though, that they thought, okay, oh, your God. And you can see the conflict of gods there, and which was very much a reality in, you know, the era when these different nations were conquering one another and invading. There was a lot of religious connotations to all that as well. And you can see, like, oh, your God's bigger than our God, you know. Or you could even see, like, our God is the God of such and such, but your God is the God over all the world, you know. So you can definitely see that attitude. Okay? All right. So languages. I think this is the last point under the culture. This is another interesting topic which would warrant some additional study, but we're just going to do the very quick summary of the language situation. So Hebrew is the most obvious language. Hebrew, of course, is the language of the Old Testament, with a couple minor exceptions, which we'll talk about in a moment. But the language of the Old Testament, so the Old Testament was written in Hebrew. Maybe I should preface all of this with saying there's a lot of scholarly study even today on the languages of the New Testament era. What were the languages that people would have known? What were the languages people were writing in and things like that? So I'm giving you kind of just a synopsis of that. But know that behind the scenes here, there's still a lot of study going on in these areas. But it's probable that the Babylonian exile, that was like three generations we were talking about in the Babylonian exile, probably led to the disuse of Hebrew among the common people, as it was replaced by the language, so it would have been replaced with the language of their captors and foreign influences as well. And we have insight into that in the Old Testament. With the return from exile, we see the influences of that type of thing. You remember that when Ezra and Nehemiah returned, one of the big problems that they faced was intermarriage. So the Jews had intermarried with the local people that were non-Jews. And what was one of the main influences then that happened whenever that, another way to ask it is, why is that intermarriage strictly prohibited? And it's because that the foreign influence would begin to lead people astray. And we even see that earlier in the case of Solomon. But in Nehemiah, we see this for sure. Actually, I'm going to read a passage from Nehemiah chapter 13. Of course, we had the whole intermarriage purification, if you will, in Ezra at the end. Actually, the last chapter of Ezra is dealing with that, sending off the people that had intermarried. Now, there's a lot of negative consequences of the intermarriage, but my point here is just focusing on the language part of it, okay, just to be clear. You could say a lot about the dangers of this intermarriage. But in Nehemiah, the last chapter, 13, remember now, Nehemiah had left and had come back again, and I forget how many years, something like 10 years later. He says, "Moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, or the language of one of the other peoples, and did not know how to speak the language of Judah." So there, you know, we got in one terse verse, we have a little bit of insight into the fact that the subsequent generations were not speaking Hebrew anymore. And that had happened probably in the exile in Babylon as well, over several generations. So Hebrew likely continued as the literary and the sacred language, but it would have been used mainly by scholars. The people who were studying the Old Testament would have been Hebrew scholars as well and would have continued in that. I mentioned the debate. It's debated whether Hebrew was spoken as an everyday language in the New Testament times. We really don't know, but there's still debate going on about that, whether Hebrew was actually a language that was spoken or whether it was primarily the language of the scholars who were reading. In Acts chapter 21, this is when the Apostle Paul was speaking to the crowd. The term that's used there is the Hebrew dialect, and it's likely that that Hebrew dialect isn't Hebrew. It was Aramaic, most likely. I think some of the translations either have Aramaic in the translation, or there's a footnote down at the bottom that says likely Aramaic. And I think the ESV Study Bible has a note at the bottom to that end. Even when the term Hebrew is used in the New Testament, it probably refers to the Hebrew dialect. The actual term there is Hebrew dialect in Greek, and it probably means Aramaic is what that means. So it would have been the language that was commonly spoken. We'll talk about Aramaic in just a second. Right, there's a lot of Aramaic in the New Testament. And in Greek, so it's transliterated in Greek. You need to think a little bit about that. You know, some of those terms, like Rabboni, is spelled that way. And why isn't it translated? And so the translators have to make those choices to say, okay, the Greek writer is making a point to use an Aramaic term there. So that's how it's usually translated. But there's a lot of cases like that in the New Testament. The Greek language, of course, we've seen in spades here that the Greek language was spread through Hellenization. The Septuagint was translated into Greek. So even the Old Testament, the God of the monotheists, the Jews, was in Greek. And that provided the common language of the entire Roman Empire, really. And the other thing the Septuagint did, of course, was it helped spread the knowledge of Judaism to the nations because they could read the Old Testament in their own language and have a familiarity with the religion of the Jews. And so the common idea here is that it's believed that the educated people and those who were embracing Greek culture or influenced by Greek culture would have been able to speak and write in Greek. So you remember Paul, who was multilingual, of course, he got the attention of the Roman commander in that same riot. I've referred to the riot here, I think, three times now in some of these passages. But he got the attention of the Roman commander by speaking Greek to him. And you remember the Roman commander said, "Do you speak Greek?" So he got his attention by speaking Greek. So we know Paul spoke Greek. And we know, of course, that Paul wrote in Greek. And it's probable that all of the New Testament authors wrote in Greek. There's a little bit of debate about some of the Gospels still in terms of their original languages, but just say that it's probable that all of the New Testament writers wrote in Greek. So we know that people that were writing were using Greek to write, and those influenced by Greek culture were speaking Greek as well. So Greek was definitely a very prominent language in the New Testament era in Palestine. And then the third language is Aramaic. We talked a little bit before about Aramaic as one of the legacies of Persia. The origins of Aramaic are a little uncertain, but it was probably a Persian dialect of the Assyrian language. We know some sections of the Old Testament were written in Aramaic. So most of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, except for certain sections. There's three sections that are written in Aramaic. Two passages in Ezra, and then a lengthy passage in Daniel is written in Aramaic. Why are those written in Aramaic? Likely because the source information that was available was in Aramaic. One of them, I think it's the Ezra one, it starts with the quotation of the letter that was written, so that would have been written in Aramaic, so it may have just been incorporated right into the Old Testament in that way. Another consideration would be if the readers that were reading it, in other words, the intended readers, were primarily Aramaic speaking, they might have left those sections in Aramaic for that reason as well. But Aramaic was, as you were saying, Bill, the common language of the people living in Palestine in the New Testament era. In this quote that we had before from Acts, the Hebrew dialect was probably Aramaic. In Acts chapter 1:19, this is when Judas killed himself. Everyone in Jerusalem heard about this, so they called that field in their language Akeldama, that is, field of blood. Akeldama there is an Aramaic term. And one of the other translations says, well, it says it here too in the NIV. Notice it says that that's the people of Jerusalem's language. People of Jerusalem's language, and then they use an Aramaic term. So it's very likely that Aramaic was the common language of the people of Jerusalem. Remember also when we looked at some of the Jewish literature and the things that were happening in the synagogue, that there was this thing called a targum, which was a paraphrased translation of the Hebrew text into Aramaic. And again, that was because most people couldn't read Hebrew. Most people read Aramaic, and so they had this translation, a paraphrased translation into Aramaic, that became the targums that were used in the synagogues. And then we already looked at the example of Paul using his bilingual skills, was able to get the attention of the Roman commander by speaking Greek to him, but then what did he do when he wanted to speak to the people and get their attention? He spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, which would have been Aramaic. And they all became quiet and started listening to him when he spoke to them in their language. So that's kind of the three languages that were around in the New Testament era. How about the implications of these languages? One implication is because the common people no longer knew Hebrew, they became dependent on scholars for translation and therefore interpretation. So a lot of the rise of the tradition and everything arose out of the fact that many of the people couldn't read the Hebrew anymore and they were dependent on the scholars to do that for them. Or they had to translate into Aramaic using the targums, which were not strict translations, they were paraphrases. So you can see there's a huge opportunity for the tradition to jump in here. And you can, of course, very obviously see the parallels to the Reformation times when one of the big things that the Reformers did was to translate the Bible into the language of the common people so they could read the Word of God for themselves. That's sort of, you've got a very analogous situation that had happened in the Middle Ages with the church controlling the scriptures and being the only ones that could read the Latin scriptures or the original languages. So the rise of Jewish tradition was at least partly a result in this change of languages. It's, you know, maybe not something that you commonly think about, but the languages play into the rise of Jewish tradition a little bit. And then to Bill's big question, what language did Jesus speak? Well, the answer is we don't know for sure. We don't know for certain what languages Jesus used. It's commonly believed that he spoke Aramaic, and we certainly know he spoke Aramaic because we have examples of that. But it's possible he would have also used Greek, and some studies have suggested that Hebrew was more common than previously thought, and Jesus may have also used Hebrew. The Gospels certainly record instances of Jesus speaking Aramaic. You remember, I've listed a couple of them here, or three of them here. When he raises the little girl from the dead, he says, Talitha kumi, little girl, I say to you, get up. That's Aramaic term. Ephphatha was be opened, that he spoke to a deaf and dumb man. And also on the cross, the famous exclamation, lama sabachthani, why have you forsaken me? That's Aramaic. So we know Jesus is recorded as speaking several Aramaic terms. So it's very likely that that was his common language. The extent to which he knew Greek and used Greek and Hebrew is probably unknown and probably will be unknown. Then, of course, the other factor with language, which we'll talk about more in a coming week, is that the universality of the Greek language, of course, paved the way for the spread of the gospel. We'll look at that when we look at the fact that Jesus came at the right time for the New Testament era to open in God's providence.